and review. And of course, as always, I have my guest, my co-host with me, if you will, Mr. John Hill. John, how are you doing this afternoon?
Very well, Jim. It's getting a little bit chilly out there today.
Well, I tell you, yesterday was the 1st of October, and I'm telling you right now, it was a chilly one. And of course, it's going to be pretty cool for the next week or so, but I think fall is officially here. And with the fall brings wonderful things going on in council.
Well, it was. And in fact, we had some great delegations that coming up before the Cobra Council last Monday evening. And basically, I saw a theme in a couple of the delegations going on. And I may be completely off my rocker in saying this, but I think there was a theme about regulation. And you know, I've been watching a lot of the American political debates and so forth, and the Tea Party wanting to shut down the U.S. Congress and that, because to them, no government is the best government. There should be no regulation whatsoever. And then in Wednesday in City of Toronto, they had their Uber debate where a lot of the taxi drivers were gathered together, and they want to see more regulation of the taxi industry so that Uber doesn't take over.
Well, it seems to me, and this just happened yesterday in front of Union Station, that an Uber taxi driver got himself in a bit of an accident, actually. And I think it was because he was preoccupied with doing other things, which actually kind of brings us to our guest that we have in the studio here, Mr. Dennis Nebiesco. He's the secretary to the Coburg Taxpayer Association, and Mr. Paul Hayden, the owner, operator, I guess, of A1 Taxi.
Yes.
Good afternoon, guys.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you.
Yeah, what I wanted to bring these fellows here today to talk about is basically go over a couple of their points that they made in their delegations to council, because I think they're very interesting, and it fits in with what I see as a theme of regulation. Dennis, welcome to the show. This was the first up for the Coburg Taxpayers Association presenting something to Coburg Council, and everybody sort of had their eyes on you as to whether or not this Coburg Taxpayers Association that was recently formed will have any impact. And I think you hit it out of the park. People were pretty astounded with the gist of what you were saying. So maybe you could just tell our listeners basically the highlights of your presentation.
Well, thank you, John. I think that this I think is about the right time to come forward with this type of delegation to identify that there's this information out, the Coburg the grants in terms of the policy that the that Coburg has put together has not really been looked at very carefully and investigated. You look at what other municipalities have done in terms of the sampling that we took. We looked at best practices, and that's what we were after. We were looking at how are Coburg's taxpayers' money being spent? What is it being spent on? And we're finding that, you know, with $250,000 being spent for community grants this year, we need to have a look at how they better spend that money.
Now, if I take it correctly, you weren't opposed to the town giving out grants to various organizations. You wanted it just to be more regulated, to be more in tune with policies that was set forth so that it would be fair and legitimate for everyone.
That's true. We don't know. Coburg taxpayers are very generous lot. I mean, when you look at how much money we give to the various organizations, whether it's the Northumberland Hill Hospital or if it's the Art Gallery or the Dragon Boat, This is not what we're looking at. We're not looking at saving money here. We're looking at how is it being spent? Is it being spent properly? Are the people really getting the dollars that they're looking for? That they're really getting something from this?
Well, is it safe to say that when donating to organizations such as the hospital and stuff like that, the actual taxpayer themselves is looking for some kind of a return, either betterment in service or maybe just a better community?
Well, they just want. I think taxpayers want to feel better about themselves in terms of where that money is going. The taxes are very high in Coburg, and that's what I keep hearing. So if you want to spend the money, let's spend the money. Let's have the process in place whereby we know where that money is being spent, what is it being spent for, and that the covert taxpayers feel good about themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was an interesting development as you got through making your presentation, and I want to come back to that. But I also want to have Paul talk about his presentation to Cobourg Council last Monday night. Paul is the owner of A1 Taxi, and he brought out some facts that I wasn't aware of. So maybe you could just give us a rundown of what you had to say to the council.
My delegation touched largely on distracted driving, and my recommendation to council was to go back to what the taxi bylaw had stated beforehand, that taxi operators had to have an office, a commercial space, with a dispatch office, in the municipality within the town limits of Cobourg. Distracted driving has become a real ongoing concern. In fact, it has surpassed drunk driving in terms of fatalities on our roadways. Right now, there are some operators that are utilizing cell phones, and instead of having a proper dispatch area, they are fielding phone calls in their vehicles. They're completing paperwork in their vehicles. They are dispatching the calls out to other drivers. This is all while they're driving. It's certainly distracted driving. And I just truly believe that a driver should be focused on the road and, just focus, concentrate on doing one job very well.
Well, it's actually just come out. I didn't want to jump on you, John, there for a second there, but there's been a new blitz going on now, and the OPP of Cobourg actually have just recently clamped down on distracted driving. Mm-hmm. People who are talking on their cell phones, filling out paperwork, whatever it is that they're doing, that's taking their mind off of the actual job of driving. Now, this blitz is going on from the 1st of October to
the end of the year.
I knew it was definitely the end of October anyway, close to it. Where they're going to be focusing, the OPP of Cobourg is going to be focusing on that kind of activity. Mm-hmm. Now, if this is the common practice for these particular businesses, obviously there is a problem here.
Yes, and I think one of the points that surprised me when you were making your presentation is that A1 is the only service in town that has a dispatch office and operates in that method. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And to be clear on this, we would actually save a great deal of money if we decided to do what the other operators are doing. However, I just don't feel right about it. I do not want to put my drivers or passengers at risk by having them try and manage two jobs at once. Just as an example, we take in, up to 400 calls a day. Now, if you can imagine, receiving 400 calls a day, those are some people calling back, other people calling to make bookings, but you're getting, upwards of 400 calls a day. That's the kind of volume, and for somebody to be driving and receiving that kind of call volume, then they have to, they have to determine who's an available driver, get that call, basically call out on a cell phone to reach a driver, and dispatch that call. Then that driver later has to call them back to let them know how much they cleared for and what their final destination was. It's an awful lot. There's a lot involved in the job of dispatching. Certainly it would be a distraction for anybody. I think, the common sense dictates that.
Yeah.
Well, on top of that, there's also my concern that when you're having open conversations like that in the vehicle, personally, I believe it's a breach of PIPEDA. There's privacy issues. You're disseminating personal information, people's names, addresses, telephone numbers.
Credit cards.
And possibly even credit information. Absolutely.
Well, let me play the devil's advocate with you, Paul. I suspect your competitors would say, you're not trying to nail us for distracted driving. You're just trying to create economic conditions so that you are the only one that can be in this pond.
I already actually, I've openly admitted, if I decided to do what the operators are doing, I would save upwards of $100,000. If I didn't have dispatchers, I wouldn't have to pay, basically the salaries that I pay. the source deduction, CPP, EI. I wouldn't have to pay additional WSIB premiums. You know, I would actually save a great deal of money. I just don't think it's appropriate. I don't think you should be saving a dollar when it puts the public at risk.
Mm-hmm. No, I think I have to agree with that because, like I was saying, there was an incident that took place yesterday in front of Union Station in Toronto. An Uber driver was filling out paperwork from after dropping off one of his customers and had accidentally got into a bit of a fender bender right in front of Union Station because he was overloaded with doing the job that a dispatcher would do. When normally you're off the air, yes, I dropped off so-and-so, the call is clear, where do you want me to go? And that's it. And then you just go where they say, okay, well, I want you to go to this place here. And then you're not writing down all this other information. I picked up from here, 25 miles to here, $35, you know, all this other stuff. We do, when we were driving cab, we would actually put down the call, like number 22, if you will, that's our call. The name of the client, Smith, address, and what time we got there, mm-hmm. or how much we cleared for. But we didn't have to take all this other information. Stalling time and wasting time with the customer that you have in the car. I'm in a bit of a hurry. I need to get there yesterday, and what are you doing? You're writing all this stuff out. I don't get that.
Yeah. Let me go back to Dennis again. When we went to the council, in the agenda that was presented, there was a pretty extensive bylaw that council was going to consider about grants given out in the community. And yet the Corporate Taxpayers Association showed up to actually critique the policy. Surely your organization didn't have a lot of time to put that together.
No, John, we had less than a week to put that together, but we did research it very carefully. We looked at 10 different municipalities. We sampled the information. We summarized it for council. We provided them with all of the details, and I believe it's something that the town should be able to do. They should be able to take this and put this together. Now, this is something that, regardless of how it gets done, the town should be able to come forward and put together a policy that is detailed enough, looking at other municipalities, looking at other, you know, what the best practices are out there, and not just putting something together that does not cover much of anything.
What has been the practice in Coburg in the past?
In terms of what?
And giving out grants. They wanted to put forward a policy. But was there no policy in place before?
Well, for example, I'll use the art gallery, and it's not because I'm up against the art gallery or anything like that. But the art gallery has had, for 2015, has had a rent of grant of $45,000, has another grant of $30,000, a sponsorship, another grant, and a special grant of $50,000. Now, when you add that up for 2015, that's $125,000 that's been spent on the art gallery this year. To the Northumberland Hills Hospital, the Coburg has only given $100,000. So that's something taxpayers should know about.
Now, does that mean that you're opposed to those grants?
No, we're not opposed to them, but it's something that we want. We want the taxpayers to know about. We want council to look at all of these grants. They should look at them at the beginning of the year when they're putting their annual budget together and identify where is this money going to go and not just scatter it here and there.
So what was the outcome? What was the result of last Monday's meeting?
Well, they deferred that for further discussion. I think there was just so much information that they looked at this and said, this is something we need to look at more carefully.
And that's why I said at the outset that you really hit it out of the park, because I think had the CTA not shown up, that the draft proposal that was in the agenda probably would have passed and would have been put into a bylaw at this Monday night's council meeting. Do you think that's right?
That's right, yes.
And, Paul, what was the outcome of your representation to council?
Mine went through, I guess, the normal channels. It was given back to the a municipal clerk to review, and then basically it will go for in front of the bylaw review board at the middle of the month. And there will be, I guess, forthcoming at some juncture a recommendation to town council through that process.
And what do you think the timelines will be on that?
You know what, I really wasn't given a true timeline when I inquired. I do know that the bylaw review board meets at the middle of each month. And, you know, if anything further to that, I don't know how long the process will take after that. You know, once they review it, to make a recommendation or not.
How do you feel that the comments that you made during Monday night's council, how do you feel the council was reacting to that? Did they seem, oh, here's another complaint, or did they seem bored? Did they seem somewhat interested in what you had to say?
You know, there's a lot that the council has to deal with, and you know, as a business owner, you know, the council basically has so much to deal with, and one counselor actually mentioned, you know, I'm not familiar with the taxi industry. I don't take taxis, you know. So it was something that they're, you know, a few weren't familiar with, and they certainly, I don't think they're aware of the problems that exist. But you know, even with the existing bylaw right now, there are provisions. I mean, there's rights, you know, there's provisions in there that clearly state you're not to use the cell phone only in case of emergencies. That all devices are to be turned off to ensure that, you know, a passenger has a quiet ride. There are provisions actually in the bylaw, you know, but it has to be mandated so that, you know, the operators have a proper office with a dispatch office, and, you know, to ensure that there's compliance. You know, the bylaw enforcement could then oversee the process much easier. Right now, vehicles are scattered all over, and, you know, they're, you know, some at no fixed address, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, I think the thing is that they gave these guys licenses to operate a taxi cab, did they not? I mean, they all have to be licensed, right?
Yes.
So would they not know that going into it, that these guys aren't working from an actual dispatched area, these guys are working from inside their cab? Essentially, I think they would probably be aware of that.
They should be.
I'm guessing, right? I mean, so that being said, I can't see, and granted, you said these guys aren't familiar with taking cabs and things like that, and I get that. But the thing is that if you want to be able to keep the roads clear and you want to be able to keep them safe for people traveling, such as myself, and not running into a guy who's just filling out paperwork and accidentally bumps into me, I think these guys should have been aware of the fact that these guys don't have an office and there is no proper dispatching before they start allocating licenses. Now, these licenses per cab, they're what, about $110, say, per cab, roughly?
Yeah, $125.
Thereabouts, right? So I don't know if it's just a cash grab for the city, whoever issues these things, or what?
How many licenses are there out there?
No, you know, it's not a question, I guess, of a cash grab. There was provisions in the bylaw beforehand,
mm-hmm.
okay, that required operators to have an office. That was removed, you know, but that was at the bequest of the taxi operators. Now, obviously, you know, it's a lot less expensive to go without an office, but again, there was that provision initially, and it should be reinstated because it's needed.
Yeah. Well, I have to agree with that, John.
Well, this gets me back to the point that I really wanted to start out with, and that is, here's Dennis, and here's Paul, and they're business people in town, and ordinarily, one would think of business people as saying to government, get out of my turf. Government just makes problems for business, and yet here are two organizations, the Quebec Taxpayers Association and A1 Taxi, coming in and saying we would like a little bit better regulation of our industry. Do you see a disconnect there between what would be perceived as your natural response and the presentations that you were making at Quebec Council?
Well, you know, without some governing body, okay, then you're going to end up with, and I'm not even going to go into anarchy, but, you know, you're going to end up with people charging random amounts. You'll end up with, you know, people that aren't vetted. You'll end up with something that's very close, I guess, to Uber, you know, which I, you know, kindly refer to as the app for hitchhikers. You know, instead of holding out your thumb, you're tapping a phone,
right.
You know, They're not licensed, not vetted, not insured, and that's kind of what you would end up with in the public. The whole premise behind the taxi industry is both public safety and consumer protection.
Right.
You know, and so there is a valued need for that. As an operator, I understand that. I mean, who wouldn't want to forgo paying all these fees, and, you know, but I think it's necessary, you know.
I think in the spirit of transparency, the Coburg citizens want to know where their money is being spent for. They want to feel good about it. They want to know where is it being spent, what are we getting for it, and those are the type of things that we need to make sure that council is aware of.
One of the things, though, in sort of democratic theory is, if you don't like what council is doing, after 4 years, you can turf them out. Aren't you really just giving the Coburg Council a soft place to land by giving them the ways that they're not going to antagonize a lot of citizens?
Well, you have to look at, I mean, people want to know where is their money being spent? What is it being used for? And is it being used wisely? They want to know, are we spending $100,000 to give to the Northumberland Hills Hospital or $125,000 to the art gallery? People should have the ability to go back to their council and tell them that, no, this is not right, that we want money spent more for the hospital or the art gallery, or if we want to spend more money for the Dragon Boat Festival or the Highland Games. That's what they should have the ability to do. But today they don't know that.
When would that decision on the allotment be made? At the budget process?
That's where it should be, because you should look at what is the dollar amount that you're going to budget for the community grants, and this is where it should be done. It shouldn't be done throughout the year, because throughout the year you're then looking for money, and that's where you get into a different ball game. Where is that money coming from? For example, like from Holdco reserves, that money should already be part of the budget process.
Now, is it your experience with the Holdco reserves that when the town runs short of money, they just pull it out of this seemingly slush fund?
Well, that's a whole different discussion, and that the CTA is working on. We haven't been able to find out what is that money earmarked for? Where is that? We know where that money is coming from. It's coming from our higher hydro and water tax, water bills, but what is it earmarked for? It should be earmarked at the beginning of the budget cycle that says this is where the money is going to be spent, not in the middle of the year and after the fact that says, look, we found additional money and now let's use it for something and let's look around and see where can we spend it.
And Paul, just wrap up here. Dennis is saying that he wants to see more transparency when funds are handed out to various groups, and you're basically saying much the same thing. You would like to see more transparency, that people become aware of how the present bylaw is being administered.
Well, you know what? If you're servicing the public, then you know the public should be able to contact you with ease. You should have a public presence, i.e., a commercial office where people can come. They can, they can make payment arrangements. They can set up accounts. They can visually see that you're a viable entity, you're upfront and basically you're a legitimate business, you know. And I think the public needs that kind of consideration.
Mm-hmm. Well, I also like to see, and I don't know if it's available, but I mean, whenever they put these budgets together, town hall, there should actually be sort of like a spreadsheet as to where this money's going and how much it is, and I think that information should be available to the public.
Well, the problem is that there are meetings that are held to determine where money is being spent and what's in the budget and so forth. But I recall the last budget meeting I spent over 9 hours at the press table, and it just all becomes a blur. I think that perhaps if this kind of information is handed out throughout the year in advance where the public has a right to know, then the whole budgetary process would look a lot more transparent than it does at the present. But I want to thank both our guests for being here today.
Absolutely.
I think it's been a good discussion on seeing how people can affect their council. And I congratulate both of you gentlemen on being at council on Monday night and trying to make an impact on the process. I'm
trying to make a difference. Mr. Dennis Nabiasco, again, the Secretary of the Coburg's Payers Association, Taxpayers Association, and again, Mr. Paul Hayden, owner of A1 Taxi. Again, guys, thanks for joining us here on Weekend Review.
All right, thank you very much.
We'll be back right after this with Mr. Brian Coggins here on Northumberland 89.7. You are listening to Weekend Review. Yeah, welcome back to the show, everyone. Of course, Brian Coggins, my co-host here, Weekend Review. Brian, hey, man, how was the week?
Well, busy as usual, but I've had fun.
Did you?
Yeah, well,
that's important. Eh? I mean, there's been a lot of great things going on these past few weeks, and I'm myself, I'm a little bit excited about just trying to have a nice, calm weekend I got planned for myself.
If you find out how to do it, you let me know, please.
I'll definitely send you an email, Mike. I'll send you an email. So what's the latest on what's going on down there in Port Hope? First, I want to congratulate them all on a fantastic turnout for the Cultivate that took place there last weekend.
I heard that it was a very successful event. I haven't...
Hundreds of people, right?
Is that right?
Hundreds of people showed up.
Of course, you went for the food, right?
Well, it's all about the food, Brian. I mean, I must be fed. I mean, no, I mean, the entertainment was absolutely fabulous. And, of course, it was a two-day event.
Yeah.
And then on the Sunday, they had a $30 plate going on there and just some great, great stuff.
And I think it's great for the municipality and for the county, for that matter, for something like this, because the whole concept behind this was to... promote local restaurants and eateries, and also to promote the use of local farm produce.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is a great opportunity for...
And don't forget the beer, Brian.
Oh, yeah, and that's right, too. There was a couple of microbreweries
there,
too. Yes.
There, actually, yes.
Yeah, so...
Big shout out to those guys.
You know, we're promoting from within, and the more we promote from within, and I'm not just referring in this particular case to Port Hope per se. I'm talking to every municipality within the county of Northumberland. The more we can promote our product, and that's not just the tourists and tourism ideal, but also these special events such as Cultivate. This brings people into the community, and they spend money here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is only going to help generate the income that's really needed to start moving forward. We all have to work together. Now, as I said, I haven't had an opportunity to talk to Councillor Palutnik, whose department really was pushing this particular promotion. But I'm sure that from what I have heard, that it brought people in from outside of Port Hope, from outside of Northumberland County. I've heard of people coming down from Peterborough, people coming in from Durham Region,
Hamilton,
West,
Toronto, all over the place.
So, I mean, this is an ideal because they come for a specific purpose. They find out what type of communities we have in Northumberland County,
mm-hmm.
and they come back. They come back not once. They come back over and over again. They also tell people that they know. They come back in groups. So in the long term, something like this may not attract the local people. It should,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't always. And there's usually various reasons. That particular weekend they're away, or they have a family commitment, or whatever. But the fact that people are coming in, they are going home enthused,
mm-hmm.
and to come back. This is a positive for us in the Northumberland County, and in this particular case, specifically Port Hope. So I'm very pleased that this went forward and that the local restaurateurs really took this to heart and really promoted it.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope it happens again. I'm sure it will.
Yeah.
But as a community, we all have to get together when there's an event like this, get out, support it,
mm-hmm.
and show how much we think of others that are coming in. Make them feel at home,
mm-hmm.
feel wanted.
If you ask, say, Dale Bryant, our resident realtor, he will actually tell you that the amount of people in the last 2 years who have come to our quiet little community, if you will, and decided to stay. They packed up, they moved from where they were, and now they're living residents right here in the Northumberland area. I can't tell you how many people I ran into at the last events that we attended, either it be the Port Hope Fall Fair or the Rib Fest or the Waterfront. Some of the responses I was getting to having a lovely time was, we always have a lovely time here, and that's why we just moved here. Or you know, we moved here a year ago, and we just absolutely love it here. And that's the thing. It's all about putting your town or your community on a bit of a pedestal, a little bit of a showcase. And the little events that you can create in and around your community, everyone's a win-win. It's a win-win. And that's why everyone in your community should attend these town functions.
That's right. That's right. And I think your comment there of people coming to visit and then deciding to stay. I mean, we have several volunteers here at Northumberland 89.7 who've done exactly that. They came to visit and decided to move here and make wherever they are in Northumberland County their permanent home.
Man, yours truly.
Yeah.
I'm only here 7 years, Brian. Yeah. Of course, well, I am only 13, so.
Yeah, well, that's true too. That's true too.
No,
13 and counting.
13 and counting. Well, 13 with many years experience at being it. So,
yeah.
As far as the Monday night council,
no, Tuesday night.
Anything?
Nothing comes up yet.
Shattering.
Well, see, there was nothing last Tuesday because remember we meet the first and third. Port Hope meets the first and third
and
Tuesdays,
and.
Last Tuesday was the fifth Tuesday of the month, one of those months that has five Tuesdays,
weeks, yeah.
So we got a two-week hiatus. However, they did have a special council meeting of Port Hope Council on Wednesday night to appoint Sue Bernardi as the permanent municipal clerk, which he's always held.
Mm-hmm.
But if you recall back in the spring when they were doing the whole reorganizational process and she became the executive director of the municipality, she maintained on a temporary basis her municipal clerk responsibilities with the intent that somewhere down the road it would be transferred to someone else. Well, at the council meeting on Wednesday night, she was reappointed as the municipal clerk of the municipality without restrictions as far as time. Back in the spring, it was only until September 30th or such times as a new municipal clerk was appointed. So, of course, September 30th just happened to be Wednesday, so they had to have a special council meeting to do that. And I'm glad to see that they have reappointed Sue as the municipal clerk. Her knowledge is going to be invaluable to the community at large.
Mm-hmm.
And also, with the reorganization that has occurred within the administration area and the appointment of a second deputy municipal clerk, there really isn't anybody on the horizon because the original deputy clerk has indicated that she would like to retire in the near future. So that the logistics would have said that she would have moved up. So Sue is going to take on this responsibility, which she's been doing anyway and doing an excellent job at keeping council under control as far as what they have to do under the Municipal Act of Ontario. Mm-hmm. So that is a big plus, and I think it's going to be a long-term positive for the municipality until such time as this a qualified person, probably the new deputy clerk, moves up the ladder after they've gained their experience, done their proper education and all the rest, or completed the education. So I think that this is a good move.
Yeah.
And probably will at least last through the duration of the term of this council.
Are we are the fish still swimming? Are the salmon still running?
Well, according to somebody that I was talking to just recently, with all of the rain that we've had, apparently the fish are just swarming upstream and downstream. So, the fish are still there.
Well, I bring it up only because we were having a bit of a problem there a little while ago where people were fishing.
them.
And they were actually cleaning the fish right there and then causing a... Well, we have a lot of birds in Port Hope, and they like to frolic like around the fish ladder.
Yeah.
And if we start cleaning our catch, if you will,
right,
we're actually going to be causing quite a chaos there. I remember there was a problem with curbing that. How's that coming?
I honestly haven't heard, to be truthful with you. I know that they approached the Ministry of Natural Resources office up in Peterborough to send more officers down to try to get it under control. There is apparently a bylaw on the books in Port Hope. So there was also some talk about using our bylaw enforcement officer to patrol and you know, issue tickets when he notices what's been going on. The police are also can issue tickets for illegal fishing.
Do we need more than one? We can't just have one guy.
Well, I think if you take, you know, there are times of the year when you maybe need two or three, and this the fishing season right now is one of them. But what are you going to do with these bylaw officers, the extra ones, throughout the rest of the year? It's hard to determine, you know, what our actual needs are.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to the bylaw officer at the municipal operations building there on Mill Street, and he was saying that, you know, he's got enough on his plate to keep him busy, but not, I gathered from the comment that he made, not necessarily enough business to warrant another person. You know, maybe what they can do is hire someone like the Corps of Commissioners or something like that at, you know, for part-time situations.
I think there are a couple of options. The commissioners would be one of them.
Yeah.
That they should probably think about, because the thing is that this is a continuous thing, and like we said, the rain, and I'm telling you right now, from Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of next week, that reservoir is only going to get higher.
That's right.
It's going to cause an awful lot of chaos.
Yeah, that's true. So I think this is something that has one resident in particular has really been pushing. And I think that over time, we will eventually get this under control.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it's going to happen this year, but we may be in better stead come the spring fishing season.
Yeah.
Back at the beginning of next
April.
Well,
when you go down to Town Park, or when you start lining that road just in front of the park, the Banshell area there, a lot of birds down there, Brian. A lot of Canadian geese down there, and they look lovely.
Oh, well.
But as soon as they get the smell of that fish, and as it's laying there in the sun, it's not pretty.
No, that's for sure. But unfortunately, Canada geese are Canada geese. So, it's not just the fish that attract them. You know, they find a place that is comfortable for them. I mean, take a look at some of the farmers' fields in Ward 2. I mean, you go up County Road 10, and you will find on occasion a field just filled with Canada geese. And I'm not talking about 10 or 20. You're talking hundreds.
Yeah, but these are cornfields.
Yeah.
Well, they eat corn. And
any of the farmers' field that's got seed.
Yeah, I see.
But particularly in the spring, they will use those fields as nesting areas, and the farmers have a bit of a problem because then they go through, if they happen to go through and plow after the nesting has taken place and disturb the nests and the eggs that are there, it creates another problem because then Canada as a whole, I think, or Ontario in particular, I think it's the Canada goose problem is a serious one. I mean, the city of Toronto has tried to move them out of the city to the outlying areas, but they come back. I mean, Hyde Park is a good example.
Yeah. Well, they're nesting birds. They find a particular spot, and you can move them over to, you know, Australia, and they'll still make their way back. That's how they are.
So I think there has to be some sort, and the Ministry of Natural Resources, I think, are going to have to come up with a program to try to find a way of reducing the population.
Because Canada geese do are a protected species, but how long do you protect them until they overrun like areas like they do now? I mean, the corner of Peter Street and Robertson Street, down by the railway overpasses there. I mean, they go right out on the road and obstruct the road.
Right.
And this in itself becomes dangerous.
Well, they're only down there because of the fish, right?
Yeah. Well, I don't know, because if you go up, into the northwest corner of the municipality too, you find them nesting up there, or not nesting, but gathering in areas up in that area too, and that's residential. So, I don't. The fish are an attraction to them. But they're all over.
Mm-hmm.
They're all over. And then, I think just my own personal opinion and people that I talk to, they're getting sick and tired of the...
birds obstructing traffic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it has come up at council on several occasions that there's, you know, they are creating a traffic problem.
Well, I mean, the thing is it's very tough to do anything with the birds, I think.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just
it's going to be a challenge. Let's put it that way.
Definitely.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that came up on Wednesday night was, guess what? The Canada Post community mailboxes.
Ah.
This was apparently a meeting was held between town staff and representatives of Canada Post on the 15th of September. And there were a number of requests issued from the municipality's works and engineering department with regards to community mailboxes. I think, as we all know, I don't think there's any way of stopping it.
No.
There's not enough mail being delivered door to door other than, you know, the advertising, the waste, as I call it.
Junk mail, right?
Yeah, junk mail.
Are you on a door-to-door, or are you on a box?
No, when we moved to Port Hope in the fall of 1987, we were on a community mailbox, which happens to be about three doors down the street.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like it, particularly in the winter.
Yeah.
And there are times when the mail will gather in there for 3 or 4 days before I get down there to get it, but... and this is going to happen no matter where you are.
Mm-hmm.
Is it an inconvenience? I guess the answer is yes and no, both. It all depends on your availability of mobility.
Mm-hmm.
I know we have a neighbor next to us who is in her late 80s,
mm-hmm.
and she finds it difficult to get to the mailbox. She goes whenever it's convenient for her to go. She doesn't go every day.
No.
My concern is for those people, and I can speak for, I don't know what's going to happen in Toronto, where my mother-in-law lives. She's 95, and her mobility is declining on a ever-increasing basis.
Mm-hmm.
And the proposed group mailbox for her is over a block away.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's no way that she's going to be able to do it. Now, that was one of the concerns that was raised by staff in their meeting with Canada Post. And basically, what has been said was that rather than 5-day-a-week mail delivery to the community mailboxes, these people will receive 1-day-a-week delivery at their home.
At the door. Now, is that gathering stuff that's already in the existing box in the last 5 days?
I gather from the discussions that I have heard is that these people, first of all, have to have a documented letter that states that they're unable to go to the community mailboxes for physical or safety's sake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even if you have to walk three doors down the street and your stability is such that you could fall.
Mm-hmm. Well, especially in the wintertime, right?
Exactly, particularly with the winter last year.
I mean, you and I, we know this one lady. She lives in the area. She's 98.
Yeah.
Although she is somewhat mobile. She, she has problems seeing and stuff, and she's not going to be climbing out of the house in the wintertime to go get her mail 3 blocks away.
That's right.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if someone comes to the house, you know, would you mind zipping over there to grab my mail? But again, like you said, a lot of the mail that's coming nowadays is flyers and menus from restaurants. And, of course, and now we have political mail coming through the door. It'd be from whatever party that you're, you know, they want you to vote for. And myself, I'm going to tell you right now, I disregard all mail that doesn't have my name on it. If it says to occupant, it's out. And that's just the way it is. I just don't have time for that kind of nonsense. And I would prefer that they not deliver to my house. However, I don't want to have to be trucking down to the local mailbox 3 blocks away in the dead of winter just to find a handful of menus and an occupant letter.
That happens quite frequently. I know I go, for instance, last week, I hadn't picked up mail for two days, went on the third day, and it was all junk mail.
Yeah.
All of it.
Yeah.
I might as well have stayed in the house.
Absolutely.
So there wasn't... It's one of those things that's paying for the deliveries, because that's not cheap to do a drop like that in the mailboxes.
Mm-hmm.
It's fairly costly. So
I would just sooner they pick a day they're going to do an area. Wednesday they deliver mail to my house.
Yeah,
I don't see them Monday, Tuesday, Friday. Thursday, they always come Wednesday, and that would be more than sufficient for me. We don't need day-to-day anymore.
Yeah, well, this is true, and this may help the seniors that only have one day a week delivery. My concern is if during that week gap, there is mail that needs, for instance, a bill of something that has to be paid in that period, and they get it after the fact. Who's responsible for the charges for the late payments? Is it going to be Canada Post, or is it going to be the citizen? Because if they make the payment when they get the bill, but it's already late...
Mm-hmm. Well, I think
it doesn't happen too often, but there is a chance that it could.
Well, I think someone ought to implement some sort of ruling there where it's a 15-day grace period.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Although it's due on the 5th, I didn't get it till the 9th, and I got till the 25th to pay it. You know what I mean? Like there's got to be some give and take there.
Yeah. That's something that the individual is going to have to deal with their local billers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other thing. But one of the things that came across my laptop this morning was from the Ontario Provincial Police. And it was very interesting because we've all seen it. And it's regarding watching out for deer, particularly at this time of the year, which is a mating season. Yeah. And we're getting, as it points out, if there's one deer, there's more than one because they never travel alone.
No.
But they had a few situations or suggestions that people should be aware of, some of which I never thought of, but, you know, when you read these things, they're sometimes good to be brought to light. And in more ways, light meaning more ways than one, of course. But the first one they get here is be attentive to your surroundings when driving, especially from sunset to midnight, and during the hours shortly before and after sunrise. These are the highest risk times for deer vehicle collisions. Well, that's common sense.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're in a hurry, you're not paying attention to your surroundings other than what's, you know, beside you, behind you, or in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
But you've also got, when you're going through these deer crossing areas, and they're well marked on all the highways and all the roadways, if you're going through that, remember what time of the year you're at, because you've got to be on your toes. I mean, I remember one spring going down to Chicago, and I was traveling Highway 402 from London to Sarnia. The amount of deer on the side of the road at after midnight when we were traveling that route, it was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I've never seen as many deer on the side of the road as I did that night. And the amount of what we call deer roadkill, in the median and off the side of the road, there were a lot of those, not only in Ontario, but as you went through Michigan,
mm-hmm,
towards Lake Michigan.
Well, I remember when I was traveling along the New York's interstate highway, there was quite a few of them. Actually, I had clipped one day with my truck. I mean, you really got to be careful. Not only that, but sunrise, sunset, the sun is so blinding.
Yes.
It's really tough to see, even when you're driving.
Yeah.
One more point there, Brian, before we go?
Well, just to finish off this list of five. It says, drive with caution when moving through deer crossing zone, which we already touched on. When driving at night, and this was something that I found it very interesting because I've never thought of it before. When driving at night, use your high beam headlights when there is no oncoming traffic. The high beams better illuminate the eyes of the deer on or near the roadway.
Hmm.
Now, sometimes that's easier said than done, particularly if you're on the 401, because even though there's a barrier and there's six lanes of traffic in this area, you really can't use high beams at any time because it is distracting to drivers on the other side and any that you may come upon. Do not rely on devices such as deer whistles and or fences to deter deer. Well, we know that because I've seen deer jumping over fences, and I'm not talking 3-foot fences. I'm talking 6-foot fences, and they go over those quite easily.
Mm.
But here is one that, although it's common sense, I would say 90% of us would do the opposite, and it says, don't veer for deer. Very alliterative, but...
Mm-hmm.
Hold your steering wheel with two hands, brake firmly, and come to a controlled stop. Swerving for a deer could lead to a loss of control and a much more serious collision with either a tree, hydro pole, or and it could be an oncoming vehicle coming behind you. Now, I had a son back in the spring, was driving the 401 westbound near Newcastle, and a deer jumped out in front of him. And he clipped it. The outcome was, I was about 5 minutes behind him. The deer was not on the road, so obviously he didn't kill him.
Mm-hmm.
He just stunned him because the deer was gone by the time I went through. But when it all was said and done, he actually wrote the vehicle off. There was that much damage.
Wow.
Because I guess he had hit it in such a way that it flipped and went and really did a number on the driver's side of the vehicle. They couldn't get one of the doors open. There was damage to the front and rear end. So, you know, when you're driving on the 401 at high speeds, you're going through Highway 2, or County Road 2, I should say now, you've got to be careful and watch for these deers because we have them all over the place here. So you've got to be very careful.
Right. Well, for sure, because, that's what it's all about when you're out in the country, my friend. This has been Weekend Review. Brian, have yourself a fabulous weekend, sir.
Well, I'm going to try. I got conned into going to a hockey coach's clinic with the Maple Leafs on tomorrow morning, so that's going to be interesting.
Oh, no, that would be fun. You should join me one morning on Leaf Chat with Dave Clark here every Friday morning here on Northumberland 89.7. Have a great weekend, bye.